Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
Thank you so much for listening, my friends. There is a link to the video version of this conversation. That YouTube link is in the description box of the show. My friend Sarah Hayter is an ex-Muslim, and she is co-founder of Ex-Muslims of North America. She joins me here because there's something very special that Ex-Muslims of North America has been a part of. It's called the Apostate Report. We don't talk a lot about the ex-Muslim, but you have, and you have a survey of some kind, or how would you describe the Apostate Report?
Yeah, so the Apostate Report is the findings from a survey we conducted of our support community members who are ex-Muslims from North America, Canada, and the United States. These are people who have been vetted by us, so to speak. They've been a part of our communities for some time. They were interviewed to have access to our community. So it's not the way an anonymous internet survey works. It's kind of a very specific sample, but it's an interesting one. And I think the findings from our survey are fascinating. I mean, I think they're fascinating. I think other people will think that too. And when we conducted the survey, you know, I was looking at what kind of information is there out there about ex-Muslim, what kind of data we have. And I mean, there's really nothing. For the longest time, ex-Muslims were a completely hidden population for, I think, obvious reasons that should be obvious to your audience. But in case people don't know, there's still an extreme stigma against apostasy, against leaving Islam, leaving religion. And in many countries around the world, Muslim majority countries, apostasy still carries a death sentence, which is pretty extreme. And I don't think that there's a parallel to it in any other mainstream religion. So because of that, ex-Muslims have been very much an underground population. But in the past couple of years, we've been coming out of the closet, so to speak. And, you know, the second I realized that we had access to this population through our communities that probably no one has ever had, you know, we asked them all kinds of questions. We asked them about why they left the faith, their drivers of apostasy, we called them. We asked them their experiences afterwards, what kinds of reactions that they had from families and friends, whether they experienced any kind of abuse and to what degree. We asked them who they hid from. Which was really interesting because we found that people tended to hide from their family more than they tended to hide from others, from friends or from people like from the broader outside world. We also asked them a lot of demographic questions, just general questions about, you know, their age, their sex. We found that ex-Muslims are slightly more male than female. That corresponds well with what we know about atheists in general. We found that ex-Muslims are highly, highly, highly educated, actually. That was a pretty shocking finding in there for us.
So the apostate in Islam, I mean, it's especially here in North America. Do we have to worry about honor killings, physical retribution, more so than you would with Christianity?
Well, certainly more so than you would Christianity. I think that's hard to deny.
That's a leading question. I mean, I already knew where we're going. But I mean, it's interesting. People will often ask me, do you think Islam is the single most dangerous religion in the world? And, you know, you can find pockets where different religions are doing immense damage. But as I look at the whole, I mean, we look at these 13 nations who have a death penalty for apostasy. And we look at jihad, blasphemy laws, those types of things. Islam just seems for me to be at the top of that list. Do you even go there, Sarah? What's your perspective on at least fundamental Islam?
As far as mainstream religions are concerned, I mean, Islam is a huge religion. It has enormous amount of adherents. It's comparable to Christianity. Judaism, in comparison, is quite small in terms of pure numbers. And I think that there's no doubt that the specific challenges that Islam poses to the world, to, you know, Muslims in particular, to non-Muslims in the sense in how we interact with each other, these challenges are unique, and they are in some ways far more difficult than maybe what Christianity poses. Part of that might be just because Islam is a younger religion and it has yet to be declawed, so to speak, in the way that Christianity has with centuries of secularism and science and modernity pushing at back at it again and again and again. And perhaps that's what Islam needs. And perhaps that is what will change Islam and bring it a little bit closer to the slightly tamer Christianity.
It is interesting, Sarah, if we'd have practiced the Joel Osteen flavor of this sort of whitewashed, happy, clappy, not necessarily fundamentalist, the Bible's partly metaphor and some of it doesn't count kind of Christianity. You try that in the Middle Ages, right? And they strap you to a spike and they burn you alive kind of thing. And
they think you're a heretic.
Yeah.
They would think that Joel Osteen, right?
Yeah, the mega pastor.
They would say that he's a heretic. Of course they would have said that a few hundred years ago.
People talk about, like when I was in Christianity, we would talk about, you know, Muslims like one thing, which is monumentally naive. Like, oh, a Muslim thinks this or a Muslim practices this. And of course, looking at Christianity, like we're saying, you've got the fundies, the people, Bible literalists, you know, the Calvinists, the people who were, the predestination people and the literal heaven and hell and the literal Adam and Eve people. And you got these other people on the other end of the spectrum. And they think, I think Jesus was a good guy. I think I believe in him, but I don't really care about it. But I'm a Christian. And then you've got this wide spectrum of people in between. And it's interesting, I think, because you have been revealing this wide spectrum within Islam, right? You've got people who are hardcore and other people over here who might be cultural Muslims. I don't know. You can speak to that better than I can.
Yeah. So, I mean, the challenge, I think, anytime you're looking at a population this huge, when we're talking about Muslims in general, is, as you said, how do you look at the whole and be able to accurately speak to, in general terms, tendencies so that we can address them without erasing the diversity within the population, which, of course, you know, there is a lot of. But I think that we can say some things generally. And I think one of the things that I feel comfortable saying is that Islam, as it's practiced today, is a far less tolerant religion than many other mainstream religions out there. I think maybe all of the other mainstream religions out there. It is especially intolerant to the people who leave it. That is something very unique in Islam. The death penalty for apostates, I don't know if there are many parallels to that in other faiths in modern times. So, and that this is something that even if an average apostate isn't facing directly, maybe they're in a North American apostate, they're not really facing it, state pressure. It reveals a kind of how deep the stigma is, how severe the demonization of ex-Muslims is. The fact that a dozen countries in the world can still have these laws and there isn't any public uprising. And imagine if, you know, in the United States or in Western countries, we had the death penalty for any kind of group, faith, tradition, or group. How insane that would be. That's something we can't even imagine happening in the West anymore, given how we feel about religious tolerance and religious freedom. These general, let's accept all religions, let's be tolerant, these sorts of frameworks aren't really accepted in the Muslim world still. And this is why apostates, even if they're in the West, even if their communities have immigrated to the West, they still face quite a bit of stigma, of abuse, of intolerance.
Well, let's talk about the leavers, right? Since we're doing the apostate report, they're giving you the reasons that they left. Sarah, I tried to read the Quran. I tried. Allah is great. Great is Allah. Allah is great. And then there's all the crazy shit in it, you know, like the sperm that's harvested from between the rib cage. And mountains being the nails that hold the planet together, and Muhammad marrying the 6-year-old and having sex at 9. I mean, I just couldn't do it. Tell me, there are people, right, who finally went back and actually, honestly, objectively read the Quran and listed that as one of the reasons they walked away, or did they?
Yeah, so we asked them several questions about what was the primary motivator, or what was a motivator, and then out of those, what is the primary motivator for why they left the faith? And we asked them whether it was internal contradictions within the scripture. So Quran says one thing, chapter one, and then Quran says another thing, you know, chapter 10. Whether it was that and to what degree. We asked them whether it was contradictions with what the Quran was saying about the nature of reality and what we knew to be scientific truths about the nature of reality and about, you know, our world. Whether it was philosophical problems. And by that, I mean the problem of evil, you know, the kinds of things that would make you an atheist, because, you know, maybe the idea of an omnipresent, omniscient God who is also good doesn't really logically hold. We also asked them whether it was Islam and its relation to human rights ideals, secular human rights ideals, and whether that was what pushed them out of the faith. And, you know, it was interesting because so many people found that those sorts of things were important. We also asked them whether it was non-religious reasons, for example, feeling disconnected from the Muslim community, anti-Muslim bigotry, or experiences of being a Muslim in the West, whether those had something to do with it. And I'm not surprised, but some people may be surprised to find that that latter had almost nothing to do with it. Very few people cited those as reasons that they left the faith. In fact, for most people, there were what I would call ideological reasons, those philosophical reasons, those contradictions within the scriptures themselves, and the fact that, you know, human rights doesn't really our modern consensus of what human rights is doesn't really comport with what the Quran thinks human rights are. You know, a lot of people found those to be very disturbing and said so in our survey.
Talking here with Sarah Hayter, co-founder of Ex-Muslims of North America, we're speaking specifically about kind of a targeted analysis of the ex-Muslim I was watching on, was it Instagram? This was a few weeks back when all of a sudden they had sort of wiped the hashtag ex-Muslim. Like, it wouldn't appear if you had typed in hashtag ex-Muslim. Did they consider it hate speech or something? And I guess it was sort of off the radar for a series of days until there was protest. Did you follow that story, Sarah?
I'm peripherally aware of what's going on. I mean, this has been for many years now. We've had quite a bit of trouble with social media companies who don't understand ex-Muslims, don't understand what we're going through, don't seem to be very empathetic either. And we're facing, you know, we are a small population. Ex-Muslims are very small. We are dwarfed by Muslims as a whole. And it's very easy on social media platforms for targeted harassment to take place and drive apostates off the medium. And what I mean by that, for example, it's a very simple thing you can do on Facebook is you can just mass report a Facebook group or a page or an individual and say that they're violating the terms of service for whatever reason. And the way Facebook works, because they don't have manual review for everything, they'll just, if enough people report something, they'll just block it. They'll just get rid of it. And that leaves ex-Muslims in a vulnerable position, because if we get enough coverage, if we get enough of a spotlight on us for any reason, of course you want to some degree, right? You want to be able to speak your mind and you want to be heard. But if you're heard by too many people, too many religious people, it's easy for them to target you and to take you down, given the vulnerabilities in social media platforms to abuse. In the case of this banning of the ex-Muslim hashtag, from what I understand, it was there were too many community reports. Is that right, Seth? There were too many community reports saying that the content on that tag is violating the terms of service. This is a very common tactic.
How can you violate the term of service by being a demographic of former believers in a religion? You know, I mean, if they did it with ex-Christian, we'd flip out, you know, rightly so. You know, you talk about consequences, though. Consequences are one of the reasons many people are hesitant to leave or at least announce they've left Islam. Mm-hmm. Societal, familial, financial, maybe even physical consequences. Mm-hmm. They worry about, as I read in the report, anti-Muslim bigotry. This obviously provides the opportunity to talk about the very real phenomenon, not of Islamophobia, but of anti-Muslim bigotry. Would you like to speak to that for us?
Yeah, well, let me just start by clarifying the distinction there. I mean, I'm sure that your audience is aware, but in case they are not, I'm very disturbed by the amount of people who adopt the use of the term Islamophobia. This really needs to go. And immediately, it's something that conflates the criticism of ideas and the criticism of people. And if we really want a discourse that is, you know, free and open and intelligent and getting closer to the truth and whatever it is while remaining compassionate, we need to be able to make this distinction between criticism of ideas and criticism of people. And the word Islamophobia does not do that. So thank you for that distinction.
I'm always sounding this alarm. And I'm amazed. Yeah. I mean, I'm a liberal, right? I mean, I'm a lefty, which speaks to my values as a humanist. And that's a whole other conversation. You can send your hate mail to Seth@thethinkingatheist.com. But, you know, I get frustrated because there are many people on the left who seem to think that going after Islam is some sort of a human rights violation. And I don't get that, you know, and they throw the word Islamophobia out. And so I'm saying, no, Islam is an idea, and ideas have to earn respect. And if it's ridiculous, it deserves ridicule, but we totally are against anti-Muslim discrimination or bigotry. Can you take that somewhere for us? Yeah, kind of flesh it out.
So the first thing is, you said you're a lefty. I'm a lefty. I have been my whole life. And in our report, we actually surveyed their political leans, the political leans of the, you know, over 550 people that we surveyed. The vast majority, and by that I mean vast majority of people, said that they were progressive, leaned progressive, or were strongly progressive, very progressive. Few people said that they were centrist. A tiny minority said that they leaned conservative or were conservative. So we're talking about a group of people that are vastly on the left, progressives in one form or another, liberals, they might call themselves. But these are people on the left. And we've all had this experience of feeling as if that the left has forgotten about us or doesn't seem to understand us. You know, I mean, I can go on about that for a very, very long time. But it is worth pointing out, I think, where ex-Muslims tend to land, and then we're stuck in this difficult position of not being able to criticize the thing that is often persecuting us if we were from a Muslim country, or the thing that's causing the stigmatization of, you know, let's say your sexuality if you're gay, or forcing you into a gender role if you're a woman. We should be able to talk about these things openly. We should be able to talk about its source openly. And we're finding that politically, this is a very difficult and dangerous conversation to have. So there's that. But to the other thing that you pointed out in the report, we also asked them as an open-ended question, what, if any, was the effect of anti-Muslim bigotry on their process of leaving the faith? So we asked them how, you know, how did it affect? We didn't want to lead them in one direction or the other. We asked, how did it affect you as you were, you know, leaving the faith? And, you know, the answers were very interesting. If people can check out the report itself, we have so many quotes from people who answered that question that I think were really fascinating. Many people pointed out that anti-Muslim bigotry, in fact, slowed down their process of questioning the faith, or slowed down their public affiliation, you know, or maybe hindered it altogether. Maybe they just chose, I'm not going to come out as an ex-Muslim right now because there's so much anti-Muslim bigotry out there. I don't want to impact that. I don't want to make it that worse, affect that in any way. So I'm not going to talk. I'm going to stay in the closet for now. That was a case of a large percentage of our respondents, and people can check that out directly and read those responses. I thought that was very fascinating. It's kind of what I expected because it's the sort of thing that people have been telling me for a very long time. I think what's assumed by a lot of people is that anti-Muslim bigotry actually pushes people out of the faith, that it creates more ex-Muslims rather than less. And I think that was the case for a tiny percentage. I think maybe two responses said that it hastened them out of the faith. But for the vast majority of people, it slowed down their process. It slowed down their public affiliation with the label. And I think that was pretty interesting.
Is that really the world we want to live in, right? Where we use discrimination against our fellow human beings to push them out of a faith? No, I mean, I don't think that's a healthy answer at all. And I get very upset about the death of nuance when it comes to so many of these issues related to the Muslim and the ex-Muslim. We always go back to the hijab, right? I just, whenever I see the hijab on Cosmo and those types of things, I'm always just like, you know, as long as the hijab is being weaponized to dehumanize women in whole nations around the world, should we be celebrating this? And again, many of my fellow lefties are like, you should never tell a woman what to wear. And I'm like, I'm not telling a woman what to wear or not wear. It's not about that. But should we celebrate it now when it's so often not free? It's not free for everybody. And it's been weaponized against an entire demographic to remove their voices and faces. I don't know, Sarah Hader. I mean, have you encountered this lack of nuance or this difficulty in trying to communicate the difference?
Yes, of course. It's been kind of, I mean, really dispiriting for me, and I think for a lot of ex-Muslim women in the past couple of years, to see the extent to which this glorification of the hijab has taken on in the mainstream. I see now all the time, it used to be just once in a while, but now all the time I see the hijab in media, in advertisements, in photo shoots on magazines. It's hard not to feel as if you, as a feminist that's fighting for the kinds of rights that Western women have already, you know, have won a long time ago, the right to wear what you want to wear, the right to have certain levels of freedom in the law that don't exist in the Muslim world. And to see that in the West, there's such a, I think it's this very thoughtless way of signaling acceptance and of signaling, look, we accept diversity. We are tolerant people, and we are going to be tolerant towards Muslims. And we as a society should be tolerant towards Muslims. And this is kind of our ham-fisted way of signaling that by putting a hijabi on the cover of just about everything, of having hijabis on advertisements and of glorifying the hijab in general. Of course, I think it's a horrible way of going about it. And it's a slap in the face for the many feminists in the East who have been fighting to have autonomy over their own bodies, to have the ability to take off the hijab. I mean, it's part and parcel of a religious system that considers the female body to be the gateway to hell, right? And so we can't forget that, and we shouldn't forget that. It's interesting to me that the very same people who are very cognizant about keeping a universal understanding of things, of looking at things from the perspective of other cultures and other parts of the world, of understanding things in a broad way, in a holistic way, are very Western-centric when it comes to Islam. Because we're focused on just this very limited view of Muslims in the West and their experiences with, say, xenophobia, right? And of course, that's true. And that's a real experience. And that's something we should be talking about. And of course, we should find ways to signal that we accept Muslims and we accept people of all religions and all backgrounds. But at the same time, can we do it in a way that also doesn't push back on the efforts of Eastern feminists and liberals who have been fighting against this religion for so long?
Wait, we got to come back to this. A woman's sexuality is the gateway to hell. I will continue this particular conversation and a lot more with my guest, Sarah Hader of Ex-Muslims of North America. We continue next. Hang on. You want the show early? You want a commercial free? Become a patron, patreon.com/Seth Andrews. Thank you so much for your support. Sarah Hader, longtime friend of mine, co-founder of Ex-Muslims of North America. We've been talking about this survey that they've just released called the Apostate Report, where they essentially sort of got into the minds and perspectives of ex-Muslims. I have linked it in the description box. You can pull the whole thing up even as we're speaking. But Sarah and I were just talking about this perception in Islam that you got to cover the woman, because if a man lusts after a woman, that means the woman is essentially leading him to damnation, maybe even leading them both to damnation. I just want to continue along this vein here for just a few. The idea is, correct me if I'm wrong, but the sight of a woman's skin. You see too much of a woman, it causes arousal in the man. Mm-hmm. It's the woman's fault, right? It's an agent of lust. She is a harlot who is leading the man astray. So it essentially puts all this shame on the woman for being a woman. I always thought to myself, all right, with a hijab, what if a guy's turned on by long drapes of black fabric? That's just a weird digression I had.
It's one of those things, you can't destroy sexuality. So if you cover a woman up, and this does happen in societies where you see conservative dress, people find ways to be titillated by the ankle that she might reveal as she's walking, or, you know, her specific gait is maybe feminine, or her voice or her laugh. And, you know, you can see this. You can see this in countries where conservative dress is the norm, that in fact there is still sexualization of women and women's bodies, but it's now in this very specific way. And in the end, all that happens is women have fewer and fewer freedoms in how to go about their day and how to dress themselves and how to accord themselves. And it's not just about dress. Many proponents of the hijab like to say, it's just a piece of cloth. It's a symbol of my religion. That's all it is. But that's not all it is, right? It's a symbol of something much more. It's a symbol of the fact that a woman, as you just pointed out, is responsible for keeping her body hidden so as not to arouse a man. I don't think that's the responsibility of a woman. And I don't think that if a woman happens to arouse a man, that she is immoral in any way. So those are two things that I disagree with.
Well, let me jump in if I can, because this is a great segue into another part of the apostate report. And I don't want to linger too long. We could talk about the hijab all day, and we have in the past. But all right, so I see the free from hijab hashtag as people are sloughing off, right? They leave the faith, and women say, I'm getting rid of this, right? No more covering. And they go out and they dress however they want. And then they post those photographs and often receive a lot of shaming and even threats from the devout or Islamic, the hardcore Islamic community. But it's got to be weird. I interviewed an ex-cult member a while back, Sarah, and she was raised in a compound, right? Almost like barbed wire on the fence kind of a place. No TV, no radio, no exposure to pop culture, no idea how to function in society. And she busts out at 18. She has no idea what the world even looks like. How does it work? What do I do? What is this? How do I talk? How do I approach? Totally, it's like going to another planet. This has to be the case for many people who come out of Islam. And this was actually revealed in your study, right?
Yes, yes. We asked respondents whether they had difficulty, once they left the faith, whether they had difficulty with the practices of secular life, like dating, socializing with the opposite sex, dressing freely. And we found that many people, in fact, did have problems with integrating back into integrating into this secular way of life, which is really interesting to me because these are people from North America. So one would think that they would not have that much difficulty because they have spent at least some time in the West and they've been absorbed in this culture. But in fact, a lot of people had difficulty for a very long time. I've personally worked with ex-Muslims for almost a decade now, and I've worked with people who, you know, even, you know, until very recently, they would say that, you know, I'm happy to volunteer. I want to work with you. I want to volunteer. I just have trouble talking to men. You know, I can't look at men in the eye. So if we can accommodate that, then that's okay. And it's just amazing the way being raised in a religious context can screw up your social relations in so many different ways, but especially your relations with the opposite sex.
Well, let me clarify something. Much of this, it was considered haram or forbidden. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? So you're trained your whole life that if you do this, if you say this, if you eat this, whatever, you mm-hmm. are in violation of Allah's law. Perhaps mm-hmm. even you might risk hellfire and torment. So you come out of that, and now the stuff that was once forbidden, they put it on a plate and they serve it up and they say, enjoy.
It's hard to do it. And, you know, one of the things we found is that ex-Muslims have a very hard time, even when they're Muslims. This is the part of the religion that almost everyone tends to hold fast to. And then even after leaving, they have difficulty with it, specifically pork, eating pork. Muslims don't eat pork. In our findings, we asked them what practices did they adhere to back when they were religious and to what degree did they adhere to it. And one of the things that they adhered to very strongly was the prohibition against eating pork. Almost no one ate pork at all. And then even after leaving, this is something that I find people have a lot of trouble with. I think it's something to do with the way that it invokes disgust. I mean, you can, relations with the opposite sex, there's a part of you that wants to do that anyway, right? People enjoy sex, people enjoy socializing with opposite sex members, especially if you are heterosexual. And then, you know, alcohol, that's fun in a lot of other ways. So there's the kinds of things that are haram that you want to explore. So you push yourself and you try to do it. But pork, it's like the thing you do. You have a piece of bacon to prove that you're this like uber ex-Muslim. You know, now you've finally left everything behind. You'll try bacon. Or have like a ham sandwich or something.
Wow. And there, it's a huge hypocrisy culture. I think this is true in Indy Fun. It's almost like when you go to extremely Mormon Utah and you realize that porn use is the highest in the state of Utah in Mormon country, because if you get into a repression culture, right? I mean, Islam, Fundy Islam is a repression culture. There's probably an underground of total hypocrites who are doing all the shit that they say that Allah doesn't want you to do, right?
Well, I mean, if there's this idea that you can cover a woman up and then you don't have problems with human sexuality. You don't make human sexuality go away. You just squeeze it into, you know, the way a woman laughs now, or her ankle that shows underneath her long gown. It's just a way of feeling like you can mold human nature that is often doomed to fail. It does fail. And we see the way that it fails catastrophically at times.
I think it's kind of a forbidden fruit thing. Right? The more you say, oh, this is off limits, you shouldn't give in to these desires, the more desirable it becomes. Let's do the happy ending. There are people who have left, many people who've left who have said, man, I should have done this a long time ago, or I'm so glad I'm out. And you've seen that borne out in the data, right?
Right. So it's one of the most interesting questions I think we asked them. We asked them a series of open-ended questions in the end after all the multiple choice questions before. We asked them, what was the best thing about leaving the faith? What was the worst thing about leaving the faith? I'll start with the worst. The worst things category, I manually went through these almost 600 answers. So many people, again and again and again, mentioned social isolation, ostracization, feeling like they were no longer part of their community, feeling like their family didn't love them or accept them, feeling like they hurt their family, they hurt their parents specifically, mom specifically, right? More than anyone else, it's mom's tears that are, you know, that people feel like, oh, this was the worst part about leaving the faith, is disappointing my parents, is feeling like I can't speak to my community anymore, feeling, you know, sometimes being pushed out of my community and no longer having contact with people from my community or even family members. So that tended to be what people said, you know, overwhelmingly was the worst part about leaving the faith. But the best part about leaving the faith, those were also pretty uniform. I was pretty fascinated by that as well, that it was almost like a parallel thing where the worst part about were these social realities. And then the best part about leaving the faith tended to be internal, the freedom to think the way that they want to think, the freedom to explore the world around them and to understand it in a more nuanced way. So freedom of thought was a big one for best parts of leaving the faith. And a lot of people said that it was just the best experience, you know, that they had once they left and they put aside these shackles, these mental shackles that they had carried for so long, finally set them aside and felt freer.
Funny, when I was a devout Christian, I always thought I was free. Then I got out and I realized now I'm free. Like I'd never go back into the matrix. We see, though, I mean, I was reading, and we'll finish sort of on a, I'm going to ask you to be Nostradamus here. Let's prognosticate a little bit, or at least theorize. But Pew Research is saying that the Muslim demographic is growing in this country in the next 2 decades or so. They projected will surpass the Jewish faith in terms of popularity in the United States. So let's contrast the growth of Islam versus the ex-Muslim. I mean, do you see a rising tide of Islam in this country? And what's that even look like?
Well, so of course we'll see more Muslims. It's a simple numbers game in terms of immigration, also the degree to which immigrants in general, like not just Muslim immigrants, but immigrants in general tend to have more kids than native-born Americans. That changes once they turn into second-generation immigrants and third-generation immigrants. As they integrate into society, they tend to have less kids too. So some of it is just this demographics numbers game. We're going to see more Muslims. We also see converts to the faith, which is pretty interesting. I've spent some time looking at studies of converts, the reasons for coming into the faith and why they do. That's another conversation that we could have. It's quite fascinating. But there are converts to the faith as well. I think, though, that ex-Muslims are growing extremely fast. I think we are growing faster than anyone can measure and measure well. I mean, part of the reason there is no such thing as there is no randomized representative sample of ex-Muslims is because we've been in the closet for so long. And this is also the reason why it's so hard to measure our growth accurately. So there are no numbers. I don't know for sure. But I can say with what I do know, what I have looked into, the degree to which there's interest now and there's a popularity of ex-Muslims, that ex-Muslims and apostasy is growing. And the best, and I've said this, I think, quite a few times, I have said it on your show as well, Seth, that to me, the best evidence that ex-Muslims are growing and they're growing fast is how Muslims are responding to ex-Muslims. There are now conferences, regular conferences. There are whole institutes that are devoted to countering the rise of ex-Muslims. There are seminars that are regularly given online and in person. There are trainings for parents of kids who might be experiencing doubt. I mean, the Muslim community is mobilizing and mobilizing rapidly against what they perceive to be a threat. And that threat is the growth of ex-Muslims. So I think that that's the best evidence, better evidence than you know, any poll or any survey that we are, in fact, growing. They sense it too. And that's why they're trying to push back.
It's almost like watching the Christian theocrats in the halls of power here. They're freaking out because they see the demographic writing on the wall and their impending, if not irrelevance, certainly not a monopoly on power. Mm-hmm. That is encouraging. I also think, too, there's got to be a huge underground of ex-Muslims, religious critics in these theocratic nations. They can't yet show their faces,
right? Certainly.
But
certainly.
I mean,
maybe even more than they have, than they exist here. I mean, because they see the problems of religion in front of them, in front of their faces all the time. We in the West, you know, we live in a secular country, in a country that guarantees a certain amount of freedom. So we don't often see how brutal religion can be outside of these tightly knit communities. In Muslim majority countries, it's hard to ignore.
It's like they're waiting, though. I mean, I think maybe they're swelling in numbers in the underground, waiting for that sort of, you know, the zeitgeist changes. Maybe there's a regime change, some sort of a cultural shift. I'm thinking of Saudi Arabia. Of course, here we in the West are saluting Saudi Arabia because they're finally allowing women to drive, as if that we consider that. I guess it could be considered progress.
It's progress in name. We'll see. I mean, in my opinion, until they say that the Quran is no longer a source of law, this is a level of liberalization that can be taken away very quickly. You know, all they have to do is say, no, actually, we change our mind. That's not Islamic at all. And Islam is a source of our law and our legal system. And it just rolls back entirely.
It's still a group of guys, men, telling women what they allow them to do. I don't know. Right. You and I could talk over coffee for freaking hours on this stuff, but you've been very generous. The apostate report, is it on the ex-Muslims website?
Yes.
A specific domain for it, or do I send people?
Yeah, they can just go on exmuslims.org and they'll find it right there on the homepage. And they're able to take a look at the full findings if they want to download it. They can also take a look at our key findings. We pulled aside about, I think, 10 of them on the site itself. They can download the graphics if they want access to the charts separately. So there's a lot of information out there. We also have articles that we're publishing based on the data that are coming out fairly frequently. We're going to be pumping those out as we're mulling through all the information that we have. So if people want to access that, our website, exmuslims.org, is a place to go.
I'll also include a direct link to the apostate report in the description box. I don't know. I'd be curious to see what the world looks like in the next 20 years when it comes to the Islamic religion. And I so appreciate the work that you guys are doing at exmuslims.org. I think, you know, you're giving people a voice. You're giving those who don't have a voice a reminder that maybe they're not crazy and that they're not alone. And maybe we can build a better world. And I think we have to start with good information. And the apostate report is a part of that conversation. Sarah Hayter, thank you again for a great conversation.
Thank you, Seth.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter for a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring the Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming free thought events and conventions. Log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.